I'm Willie D. Nelson from All Things Good and Nerdy, a pop culture podcast, part of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned, and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other tantalizingly geeky shows at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And welcome to Play Comics, where we remember that video games exist. This time, we are talking to Zach Jenkins, looking at X-Men Legends 2. Zach and his wonderful, I think, maybe cheating level amount of preparedness for this, because he runs a little podcast that you may have heard of called Battle of the Atom.
Hey, yeah, I do that. What's up? How you doing, Chris?
I'm excited for this. Do you know how many people have asked me to do one of the X-Men Legends games?
I'm going to say upwards of six.
Try like 60.
That's a lot.
I'm serious.
I'm honored. You wasted this on me? That's insane, Chris.
Well, part of it is because I had to repay you for looking at the horrible Game Gear game the last time you were on.
Yeah, that was what? Was that 2 years ago? 3 years ago? Something.
Wait, it was in the before times. That's all I can remember. Time is weird.
Yeah, we're in the weird times now. But we're just keep on trucking along. We're enjoying a fun little X-Men stuff. And yeah, I'm excited. Rise of Apocalypse was a game that I have a lot of fond memories of, and it still kind of holds up. So I'm really excited to dive into this with you.
So Rise of Apocalypse came out in 2005. What was going on with X-Men around then? Because I was not reading comics.
That's a great question. So specifically, X-Men was celebrating the 10-year anniversary, which in comics, 10 years is not very long, but it does, in my mind, feel like a giant gulf because it was the 10-year anniversary of the Age of Apocalypse storyline, which was this big old crossover that canceled all the X-Men books and relaunched them in a alternate reality where En Sabinor, the first one, Apocalypse, he had taken over the world. And mutants were fighting him in this weird old, like, dystopian future that you would think was sucked up into, like, super 90s grim darkness, but is actually more fun and self-aware than you remember. And it kind of rules. Like, a lot of people have a lot of negative things, like, on the concept of Age of Apocalypse, and I understand it, but I dare you to read the stories and be like, oh yeah, no, this is bad still, right? No, it completely takes you for a fun ride, and I love it.
So are we talking like The Room bad, where it's so bad it's fun again?
No, it's, you go in there with low expectations, honestly, because it's a 90s Scott Lobdell comic. Fabian Nicieza also does it, but Lobdell was the big driver of it. And there's a bunch of other creators, Jeff Loeb, Warren Ellis. So, you know, the quality. You may be going in with some interesting ideas, but no, it's hit after hit after hit. And it's a fun time. I'm a big Age of Apocalypse fan. And my X-Men fandom was, like, originally kicked off by the, like, the publishing house DK put out these encyclopedias of, like, here's all this visual stuff you need to know about the X-Men. And for a kid, it was super cool because I could, like, just download all of the history into my brain without reading anything and just look at these cool pictures and be like, man, this two-page spread about Age of Apocalypse with all these nifty-looking costumes, that sure is neat. So I internalized that from a young age. And it turns out the comic itself was also neat.
What exactly is up with Apocalypse? Because most of what I know from him is that he is in X-Men versus Street Fighter.
So, Apocalypse is interesting. You could argue, and I would, that Mainline 616 Apocalypse had not had a good story until 2019. There is pockets of things where he's good. The Fall of the Mutants story from the 80s is pretty fun. But in general, he's been a pretty bad character. He's a ancient mutant who grew up in kingdom times Egypt and was a raider and then a slave, and then he came up and led a rebellion, and then the mutant who's obsessed with the idea of being the strongest one there is, survival of the fittest. Like, he is that Darwinian idea taken to insane comic book lengths. And that was his whole deal for a while. He was mixed up with, like, religious imagery. Like, he always had his four horsemen of the apocalypse, and he would always give characters new cool designs. Like, Archangel was one of his first ones in the comic timeline, or in the comics. He went from, you know, Warren's kind of boring I'm an Angel Man design to the cool Walt Simonson with the big old blades and the, like, the pink and purple suit. Really works. But people would keep repeating that over and over and over again, and he had gotten stale. So in the 2019 soft reboot House of X Powers of 10, it was revealed that Apocalypse has a long history with the mutant island nation of Krakoa, where you know about Krakoa, right, Chris? Are you aware of Krakoa?
I am aware of Krakoa.
The thing about Krakoa is it's one island, but it actually used to have a separate island called Arako. And even before then, Arako and Krakoa were split, Arako and Krakoa were the one land, Arako. But then the enemy with his Twilight Sword split the land in two. And Apocalypse was there for that. He remembers when Krakoa was young. And it turns out, we find out in the incredible story, Ten of Swords, which there's going to be people who's going to tell you that the 22-part crossover from last year, Ten of Swords, was bad and overlong and didn't have enough sword fights in them. And all of those complaints are wrong. It is fairly long, but it's good long the entire time. That's when you get the secret history of Apocalypse, where it turns out Apocalypse is a wife guy who's just trying to get back to his family and trying to make them love him because they were on Arako and they had to go fight in this demon dimension called Ameth. And all of his kids left away, and his wife, Genesis, her name's Genesis, he's Apocalypse, Revelation Genesis, you get it, bookends. She went away and she left him on Earth because he wasn't strong enough. And it's great. And anyway, they have an anime sword fighting tournament to determine their love for each other. It's fantastic. And then he's walked away into the sunset with his family. It's so good. Apocalypse is great. None of that's relevant to this story. I just want everyone to know that Ensabinor is more than the guy from the 90s animated series yelling, you know, I am the rocks on the shore, crash upon me and be broken.
Also not relevant to this at all, but I have to know. What do you think Apocalypse thinks about Way of the House Husband?
You know what? I have not read Way of the House Husband. I am aware of its existence. Here's the thing. Apocalypse loves his wife. That's the thing. He's a Jonathan Hickman character now, and Jonathan Hickman characters are wife guys, and I love that form. It's great. I don't think that... I don't think that Apocalypse would be happy being a house husband, however. Even if he wants to put a life of violence behind him, I think Apocalypse would be happier being an active participant in, providing for the family. This is not to take away from anyone who stays at home. My wife does it, and she loves it. She does so much for us. But I feel like Apocalypse wouldn't have his innate needs fulfilled by that. That wouldn't be what gives him energy and gives him joy throughout his day. So I think he would enjoy reading Way of the House Husband, but he would not want to model his life around it, if that makes sense.
Makes perfect sense to me. And, you know, everybody has their things that they like to do, whatever. You do what makes you happy. If that is staying home and taking care of the house, then do it. If it's going out and smashing people and making harbingers of the apocalypse, maybe don't do it. because I like having a world, but, you know, go to the batting cages, get your anger out.
Yeah, see, that second one makes a lot more sense, actually. But yeah, Apocalypse is interesting and good now. Before then, he was the head of a really cool story that was named after him, and that's about it.
So how does somebody who is not that good at the time get a whole story built around him? Is it just because he's big and strong?
Yes. Yes. Exactly what it is.
I was joking. Is that really it?
I mean, kinda. Here's the thing about Apocalypse. Apocalypse comes from a long line. Apocalypse was not initially designed by Walt Simonson, but driven by Walt Simonson. I believe Jackson Geist did his iconic classic design, and then Simonson pretty much drew him for his biggest starring role after that and really kind of like solidified this is what it is. If you know anything about Walt Simonson, you know Walt Simonson is very influenced by Jack Kirby. A lot of his stuff is an evolution of Kirby's kind of blocky, poppy, big kinetic style. That's Walt Simonson in a nutshell. So Simonson takes this idea for this big guy, this absolute unit, and he's like following in the line of Kirby's absolute unit, Darkseid, over at the Detective Comics Corporation. He is in that vein. Same with, you know, the Jim Starlin Thanos, all coming from that big, hey, I am the evil dude. So the X-Men needed their own evil dude, and they're looking for, hey, what's a dark future? Let's go with that. In fact, the Age of Apocalypse storyline was actually inspired by the ideas that were being pitched for the X-Men animated series. So comics have a shorter production time than a season of television, as you might imagine. So when the X-Men writers, Scott Lobdell and editor Bob Harris, were hearing what they were doing for, I believe, season 4 of the show, they heard a pitch for like their big, or their like mid-season arc. It was called One Man's Worth. And it was a story of what happens if Charles Xavier gets killed back in time. And that story doesn't have Apocalypse in it. But they liked the idea. That's where they're like, okay, well, Age of Apocalypse. If Charles Xavier's dead, what happens? Well, what if Charles Xavier dies saving Magneto? Well, then Magneto's good. And then what if Magneto's good? And then it's all of these things, you know, for want of a nail kind of style that rolls out. And then they landed on, well, Apocalypse is like the big, powerful guy, and he wants to take over the world. Why can't he do it? And then we get Age of Apocalypse.
That's crazy, though, how a little thing like that can just snowball into one of the biggest X-Men events of recent history.
It's very interesting because they thought it was such a cool idea. And the more they thought about this alternate world, like, this is taking the idea of an event comic and running it writ large. Like, this is them saying, let's go bigger and better than ever. So in the 90s, there was almost an arms race in the 90s. You know, you had in like 91, 92, a bunch of big artist-driven titles that were soaking up the sales. Spider-Man number one with the Todd. You had Rob Liefeld's X-Force number one, and then X-Men number one with Jim Lee. Still the highest selling comic of all time. Like, it blew everything out of the water. So they kept escalating. DC had the death of Superman. They had Nightfall, where Batman's back gets broken. They had, you know, events like Executioner's Song on the X-Men side. They had Maximum Carnage on the Spider-Man line. Like, they kept trying to do big things to generate sales and keep things running. So they said, you know what? What's bigger than just doing a big crossover? How about we cancel every book in the best-selling line of comics and just like make a big statement? Because this is before solicits came out. Like, that was just something your comic shop guy used to like make his orders for the week. It wasn't public, it wasn't part of the marketing. It was, let's just do, everything's done. We canceled all of the X-Men books. People freaked, and it rules. Because they're like, and then we're gonna replace it with these cool X-Men, these new 90s gritty X-Men. And it was such a hit that they continued to like reference and go back to Age of Apocalypse for years leading up to this and leading up to the 10th anniversary, which, you know, if I think of a decade ago in comics, like, they're not doing a Fraction Aha Hawkeye decade celebration this year. They should, but they aren't doing it. Age of Apocalypse, they were like, no, 10 years ago? Yeah, this was a big deal. So they had this game come out. They did a Chris Bachalo and Akira Yoshida series in the comics. Like, they did a lot for Age of Apocalypse.
So let's take a look at some of the other characters who are in this, because there are other people.
There are. That's the thing.
Let's look at some of the other characters that were in this, because I'm assuming there were people other than Apocalypse, because just a one-person story could work, but not for very long.
No, definitely not. So in this, you switch around to the game, which is like the sequel to the first X-Men Legends, right? Which I believe you guys have already talked about here.
Yes, we have. That episode has been released. There will be a link in the show notes.
Boom. So you have a lot of the playable characters from that. Not Magma, blessedly, or Jubilee and Psylocke, or Emma Frost and Beast in the baseline version. We'll get to versions in a second. But you got a really cool lineup. Like, the idea for this game is the opening cinematic opens with the X-Men having to save Xavier, and look at that, they have to team up with the Brotherhood to do it. So Magneto, he's here. Scarlet Witch, Toad, Juggernaut, they're all here having a good old time. And then you also get some real fun additions, like Sunfire's on this team, everyone you would expect otherwise. And then you get what I remember from this game is the weird unlockables, because I played this on the PlayStation Portable, which was a great way to play a dungeon crawly game like this. And there were some exclusive characters to that are great. Dark Phoenix, which, fine, whatever. But Cannonball was there, and I love me some Cannonball. Sam Guthrie is a good boy. Yeah, you got Cable, and you have X-Man from the Age of Apocalypse. Now, Chris, do you know much about X-Man?
I know that he is a person that exists. That is about it.
Ah, yeah, so that's Nate Gray. He's the test tube baby of Age of Apocalypse, Scott Summers, and Jean Grey. He was raised by Mr. Sinister, and then in slave pits, and then he ran away and got raised by a traveling theater trope that Forge was running, where they did Shakespeare in the Park. And then he has unlimited cosmic power, and he does a big fight and got transported to the 616, and now he's here. He's a bad character, and he's mostly been in bad stories, but as a kid, I loved the idea of him because he was the super strong one. Like, he was Cable if Cable didn't have an evil robot virus running his body. He was just a very powerful, big bruiser. Like, he has the same amount of appeal that people who like Goku from the Dragon Ball Z's, they like him because he's the big, strong one that can shoot the lasers and whatever.
Well, we're going to ponder over this Dragon Ball Z comparison while I drop some promos for a few other shows.
Do your hobbies include comic books, movies, television, and or video games?
Are you always behind with the latest news in the world of nerd?
Well, look no further than the Oblivion Bar, a nerd culture podcast.
Oh, great Scott!
Hosted by Chris Hacker and Aaron Knowles, the Oblivion Bar offers a weekly review of all the latest breaking news, in-depth discussions far beyond whether Han shot first, and newsletter section, where you, the listener, send in your questions to be answered live on the show.
New episodes every Monday, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Google Podcasts.
I'm just so freaking excited!
You can also find us on Twitter, at Oblivion Bar Pod.
Come join us at the Oblivion Bar Podcast.
Hope to see you there.
Hey there, I'm Alex.
And I'm Ryan.
And we are the host of
Suck My Fanfic, a weekly literary review of fan fiction.
Let's be real, guys. We all, whether it was once on a rainy night by ourselves or in a big group of friends, have all read fan fiction.
Or maybe over the shoulder of the person next to you on a bus.
Perhaps. It doesn't matter where, but we've all done it. We are here to cut through the smut and give every fan fiction their fair shake.
Because there's a lot of good creatives out there, and you might not know it. It might be the person sitting next to you right now.
Might be your best friend.
Your bank teller.
Could be you. Who knows?
Whoa.
Join us each week as we
tackle a new fandom,
talk about some stories,
and make a couple of jokes along the way.
You can find us on Fireside FM, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Thanks.
Those are some great shows to check out, but first let's finish up with this one. So, Zach, I want to get something out of the way real quick.
I'm here for it. Let's go.
This game was on N-Gage.
This was on the N-Gage. Everyone remembers Nokia's phone that was also a video game console that they really tried to push, but it had some serious design flaws. Like, to use it as a phone, you had to use it as like a taco on the side of your face, like talking to the side of an old phone. Like, not like a, like I'm talking about the short side of like a candy bar phone. You had to talk in it like that. Also, to change games, you had to take out the whole battery.
Yeah, that's the weirdest part to me. Like, maybe if you wanted it for one game, it could work. Just treat it like one of those old LCD games.
That's an expensive, like, most LCD games don't also come with a data plan. And that's the problem.
Well, I mean, what are you going to do, right? Like, why would you ever even want the N-Gage version of this game?
Well, because, that's a great question. The N-Gage version had exclusive characters to it as well. Beast, you could play. Actually, that's it. That was the only exclusive one, because Sabretooth was exclusive to the PC version. So yeah, it's just Beast. Do you really like Beast and want to play Beast in this game? Then you have to buy a Nokia N-Gage.
I mean, I guess if you're a completionist.
I mean, this is actually the weird thing. There is a active community, and I actually don't know how active it is now 16 years later, but for a very long time, there was a big community of folks who would mod the game to add characters to the PC version. Like, they went all out with brand new models and powers and all this stuff. Like, there was a big modding community for this to put in whatever characters they felt like. So listen, it's easier to, you know, get the PC version and run Beast off of that than finding a Nokia N-Gage that works.
I really want to find a Nokia N-Gage just so I can say that I held it.
I remember seeing one, and I never wanted one, but the fact that, like, it existed, it was like a, I don't know, it wasn't even like a Zune, because I feel like a Zune was like, cool, oh yeah, you can get an N-Gage for like $50. Oh, this thing looks worse than I remembered. It has a 4x3 screen. Oof.
Oh, flashbacks to original Game Boy games.
Yeah. But again, it was that, but it was a phone. Let's see, okay, so let's hold on. I want to go down this train of thought. So, if you want to get the Nokia N-Gage, that's going to cost you about $50.
Okay.
Now, do you want to be able to get X-Men Legends on the Nokia N-Gage?
For the sake of argument here, I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, so that's going to add another $100 to your N-Gage purchase.
Well, I'd certainly rather have the game than the N-Gage, so that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, it's a weird situation. I did not realize there was an aftermarket for N-Gage games. I guess it makes sense, but still.
I mean, everything else has been pretty dug up as far as retro games go, so it makes sense to me just because it's what's left.
Yeah, I don't like the idea of retro being things that I played in high school. I feel like I'm not that old, but now I guess it is, and that's unfortunate.
I graduated high school the year this came out. I'm old.
You say that, that just means you're in your 30s. That's not that old. You're not even at the halfway point of life. You got time, my dude.
To be fair, I've been saying I was old for a long time.
Well, whom amongst us has not? But yeah, this game, it's got a lot of cool characters. It actually, for me, I really like the polls for the bosses, because this is, you know, like a gauntlet-style dungeon crawler, where you get the fun thing of being able to play four characters at the same time and swap between them, which there weren't, like, I think until X-Men Legends the year before this, there weren't any games, superhero games, that like gave you the feel of you were playing as a team. Like the X-Men arcade game, maybe, because you could do four or six players at the same time, but like for consoles, nothing got you that same feeling as I'm gonna play with a bunch of people and it's gonna be like the same feeling as a a comic book team. And that's what the Legends line really did, and then they extended that to well, they did a Fantastic Four style spinoff of this when the Fantastic Four movie came out. They did the Marvel Ultimate Alliance games that they, you know, brought back a couple of years ago. Whenever they did the one for the Switch, that's really fun, but has it's really fun, but it just has they decided to give like 8 different currency forms to upgrade your characters, and it sucks to do that. Like there's large portions of the game that I'm looking at it and they're like, here, you can use these 4,000 different versions of ISO 8, and I said, no, I don't need these buffs to beat this game. I will suffer without going through this menu.
And a lot of these bosses are people that we haven't seen in the games before. Some of them I haven't even heard of.
You got some weird ones. You got characters from the Age of Apocalypse. So you got Holocaust, Mikhail Rasputin, Abyss, and Sinister. Those are the four horsemen in the Age of Apocalypse. But you also get the Sugar Man. Do you know about the Sugar Man?
I don't know about the Sugar Man.
The Sugar Man is from the Age of Apocalypse. He's a capitalist that runs an energy farm that's run by slaves, and he's a big booger looking dude with four arms and a hammer and an axe and a tongue that will stick ya, like just a real long prehensile tongue. He's weird. I mean, like, you get some classics on this Team Omega Red. You have to fight at one point early on. Apocalypse, obviously. Bastion is there for some reason. Sauron, the Dinosaur Man, and Tiny Jorts, he is around. But then you got like Zealot. You know Zealot from that one Magneto story when he ruled Genosha?
Yep.
Yeah. It's wild what they pull from here. It's a good game though. Like it's fun. And here's the thing, it holds up. That team up gameplay style is a lot of fun. You get that light RPG progression that like Gauntlet's always so fun for, because you're grinding, but you're always grinding towards something.
That playing with other people, I think, is the best part. Like, yeah, I could play by myself, but you know, you get this on GameCube on purpose because you can just plug in your four controllers and you don't have to go get a extra controller tap.
Oh, absolutely. It's fun to do it like that. It makes for a really exciting and enjoyable gameplay experience. And that's that's one thing that I have missed. Like, I played a lot of games when I was in high school and college in like a group setting. We would do four player whatever on everything. We played a lot of Halo when I was in college, and it would be like every night, it would be late, we'd be coming back from studying and all of that, we'd just sit down and do split screen Halo online. It was a blast. That social environment for games is something that I do feel like has been lost in the last little bit, and I have so much more fun playing games. Like we were talking off air, I've got a 5-year-old son who is just at that point where he can play video games with me without it being like a frustration. Like there's still games he can't play. We tried to play Donkey Kong Tropic Freeze, which is a hard game for me, an adult who's been playing platformers for his whole life. So for him, no, he just wastes all our lives. And that's frustrating. And I understand it because that's very difficult. But like being able to play like, what do we have? Super Mario 3D World. That's a fun game to play with him because he can solve things, figure out things just as well as I can. And you get that additional excitement of doing it with somebody and that sense of accomplishment that comes from that. So it's really fun. And that's one of the best things that this game captures is getting to play with other people. And also if you get to do that while pretending to be your favorite X-Men, that's fun too.
I mean, doing it with such a team-based comic like this, I think is the perfect place to do it. You know, Fantastic Four, yeah, that could have worked as a first thing. Even some of the earlier Avengers games, like if they had multiplayer, it was just, okay, yeah, we have multiplayer because you just have multiplayer. X-Men, though, it just makes perfect sense.
It really does, because if I'm looking even at those early Avengers games, like I had on the Genesis that side-scroller beat-em-up, that they did with had Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, and then John Byrne, White Vision. And with the exception of Vision, all those characters just felt like you were playing a solo game with the big iconic characters that you knew. Like even at the time, Iron Man was a step above Vision. Like he could hold his own book. Could he hold it with like stellar sales? Absolutely not. But at least he was a different tier. Where the X-Men, what? Wolverine is a solo character. But even then, Wolverine is also the main person on the team. Like he is there. He is a teammate to them. So having him in this game plus other X-Men, like it feels right, it feels good, and it's fun. You get special team moves when you execute like different special attacks at the same time as one of your teammates on the same target, and it comes up with like a cool combo name like Icy Freeze or something, or Icy Blast, or like Burning Claws, or whatever it is when you're like combining two powers. And it has this really energetic voice actor who's narrating the thing, and he's like, combo, and it gets you. Like it makes you feel like you're playing and you're real excited about it the whole time.
And the fact that you have like 37,000 different characters that you can combine into this team, I mean, you can make this team however you want. Go make it a bunch of tanks. Go make it some sneakies. Play the game your way.
When I first learned about X-Men Legends, it was in an old issue of Nintendo Power. And I remember very specifically, they were talking about how you could change the team to like suit whatever needs you wanted. And they were like, you could make Colossus, you know, like how he normally is, which is the big, strong brawler guy. Like he's your tank. Or you could make him like an agile ballerina. And I thought that was the funniest thing ever when I was 12 years old. So I tried to do that. And actually what I did, because I was bad at understanding how video games work, I tried to make everyone every stat be the exact same for everybody. So they were just right in the middle across the board. And that wasn't good. I came back to this game when I was older and I realized that the best way to play it is when you min-max literally everything. It's just throw them all in one bucket. You got Cyclops? Cool. He's going to be using his energy blast and you cannot let him get touched. But if you just keep using your optic blasts, you are going to knock out everybody with some distance and some power. Like you could play the game however you wanted, and it was still an equally valid and fun way to play. And what this game does really well that like I hated about the recent Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3 is that while your primary characters leveled up at like the regular rate, like because you were playing them and using them, everyone else leveled up at like 75% of that. So they got residual XP. So it didn't feel like you were locked into the characters that you started with. It felt like you could switch out and be like, okay, well, you know, I think my team was Iceman, Cyclops, Nightcrawler, and maybe Storm. No, it was Gambit. Let's not pretend I was cooler than I was. It was Nightcrawler, Iceman, Cyclops, and Gambit. That was my team. And at a certain point, I was like, well, I don't want to use Gambit anymore. I'm going to use X-Man because he's big and powerful, can shoot lasers and stuff. He can't shoot lasers. I don't know why I keep saying that. He's just got a lasery eye. He used telekinesis. It's fine. But like, you could just switch out a character and it would work. Or you're like, I'm just bored. I want to try something else. You could throw in a whole new group of people and it was fun. Like, it allowed you to keep playing the game however you wanted and was very flexible about that. Like, there was loot that you could use to buff up your characters with, you know, armor or whatever. And all that was easy to transfer. And if you didn't want to screw with that, it had a button that said you can automatically get rid of all the boring, like, menu selection stuff and just run with it.
Having that residual XP reminds me a little bit of, like, the Final Fantasy style materia stuff where,
yes,
yeah, your characters are going to go, but you still have your spells going up. So yeah, I have this character that's only level 12 and everybody else is level 45, but they have like a level almost top spell because I've just been having the materia on everybody else.
Yeah, it's a very good way to allow you to play that catch up and experiment. Because if you get locked into the same characters, even with a game like this, this is still a dungeon crawly beat 'em up game where you're mashing the attack buttons in different orders. Like, it can get stale. But the value of this game is in the giant roster. So if you can still be doing the same thing, but in slightly different ways, it keeps it fresh and it keeps you wanting to come back and play this game.
Now, does this one have parts in it where you have to use a certain character to be able to get past the point?
Yes, but they learn from their mistakes in the first game. So, biggest mistake that they fixed is you are not caught in between missions, only having to have one player play the least interesting character and explore. Like, you still have bases that you can explore and stuff in between missions, though they change each one. Like, it starts out in an outpost in Genosha, and then it moves to the Savage Land at one point. It jumps to the wreckage of the Xavier School, because it does get blown up, as it should, all the time. The Xavier School's got to blow up frequently. But it keeps doing that, and it keeps you with, you know, just your team. It's just the four players that you have. They can explore, and not Allison Kressmeyer. And then what they do is they still have some of those points, but it's like you have to have one of three different types. So, like, instead of you have to have Iceman to make an ice bridge, it's like, well, you can use Iceman, you can use Magneto, you can use, like, Jean Grey to do a telekinetic thing. Like, you are locked into, like, one type, and there's multiple solutions to breaking through different parts. And even when they have those, like, real barriers to use your powers to progress in the story, there's always conveniently a character swap out spot, like, one room behind you. So you can always just grab what you need real quick and keep going. So it's not too much of a impediment, where in the first game, like, there was points of frustration where you had to go way far back, find this character that you don't want to use and bring it over. Or you had such limited uses, like Nightcrawler could teleport in that game and you needed him to teleport for specific things, and then you got locked into having to use him.
Even if they had the one character you had to use there, just having the character swap out spot that close probably would have fixed it. But I really love that touch of having options of how you can do it and not just be locked into having Iceman to make an ice bridge type stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it always comes down to weld this thing, or, you know, tear down this wall, or all this that is very much a press a button here and we have a slightly different set of actions to progress. But the fact that there's multiple ways to do it makes it feel less cumbersome and more like the game is playing with the fact that they have superpowers in a unique and fun way.
And then the voice acting on this, they've got some people.
Yeah, so they've got D. Bradley Baker does Nightcrawler. They've got Steve Bloom, who is doing Wolverine. I'm trying to think if the Legends line, I believe, was the first time he did he voice him in I'm trying to think now if he did Evolution or not. I don't think he did. No, it looks like he didn't. So yeah, when he started doing the video game stuff, like, he became the voice of Wolverine for a lot of people.
That you've got John DiMaggio coming in here doing Juggernaut. Anytime you have John DiMaggio in there, I'm sold.
Do they still have Patrick Stewart doing Xavier in this one? I know he did him in the first one, and I don't know if they got him back for the sequel.
Yep, they still got Patrick Stewart in there.
See, like, that's a darn good voice cast.
I mean, having anybody besides Patrick Stewart at this point would have just been horrible.
I think it's interesting because, you know, this comes out the year before this is the year before Oblivion, right? Because that was 2000, Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion, which made a huge deal about having Patrick Stewart as a voice actor in this. And you get more Patrick Stewart for your money in X-Men Legends Rise of Apocalypse than you do in Oblivion, where he immediately dies. Spoiler alert for a very old game.
It's been on my list. I don't know if I want to play it anymore.
Okay, here's the thing.
I'll get over it.
He does die in the prologue. So it's like... You were going to get that pretty quickly. Now, does Sean Bean's character die? I don't know. I didn't get all the way that far.
I'm going to assume he does just because of Sean Bean.
I mean, that's a good assumption. But yeah, you got Tara Strong does some voices in this. Peter Lorre does some voices in this. There's some good stuff here.
I mean, this is not the era of really good voice acting in games. So, yeah, if you look at it from how they're coming out today, some of it's kind of clunky. Some of it's not well done. But especially looking at this when it came out, keeping all of that in mind, this does a really good job.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of it, too. The production value of this game is huge. Like, there's some really, really sharp cinematics that they do in this. I couldn't tell you if the music's good. I bet it's perfectly fine, I'm sure. But like the style, they do a cel-shaded look, which especially, so I had it on the PSP, and that made it so much better that it had that cel-shaded look, because that translated a lot better to a smaller screen than if they tried to do like hyper detail. Like, I remember there was a God of War spinoff on the PSP that I had the demo for, and I got frustrated because they tried to do like this very realistic, you know, high-end graphics kind of look on it, but the PSP only had so much power, and it was easier to scale down stuff like cell shading and, you know, more simple character models that they have here and still make it look really sharp. And I think they executed on that real well.
Cell shaded stuff just lasts so much longer anyway, I think. Really doesn't look its age as much as when they have something that comes out. Yeah, this looks so good. And then 3 years later, it looks like trash.
Because what you get to do with cel shading is that the appeal is really coming from the character design. It's not net. I mean, there's some stuff like with your lighting and your visuals that pop with that, but you are not using a high polygon count to be driving your, like, your visual pop in this. It's why Legend of Zelda Wind Waker still looks great, and Twilight Princess looks its age.
16-bit Zelda is always going to be the best. You guys can come fight me on Twitter.
See, I'm not a huge 16-bit Zelda guy. I am a huge 16-bit Metroid guy. And I think that one may look the best. Like, hold on, do you really think Link to the Past is the best visual Zelda game? I'm not saying best gameplay, visually, though.
Oh, no, not visually, no. But they're just the best, overall.
They're fun. I do like getting lost in SNES games. In fact, I'd like to joke that everything that I play, for the most part now on my Switch, is this could have come out on the SNES. Like, not all the way, but like, you fudge a few things, you're pretty much there. Because I guess I'm caught on that cell. Like, I'm not someone who needs to be like, I need to have the
biggest, longest game. I need something that's fun. Give me something I can pick up and put down in 20 minutes, get a good time out of, and get on with my day. And that was one thing that I really liked about this game. Especially having it portable beyond load times that were maybe the worst thing in the world. Like, we're talking minute and a half load times between certain things. Again, the PSP was a lot of things, but trying to run an optical drive was a choice they definitely made. But this was one you could pick up, get through a few rooms, grind some levels, and then go to your algebra class or whatever. Like, it worked really well for that. It's a good format. People should use this more. I don't understand why they don't.
Well, now that we have the Switch, there's really no excuse because people should be doing it more.
And that's
maybe
the thing.
Maybe get Sony to bring back their portable line.
Listen.
They won't, but I can dream.
I got all I need. There's people who are like, oh, you need all these. I'm not a fancy schmancy graphics boy. I need to be able to play whatever I feel like. Just wherever. Though it is funny, earlier today I was complaining like to one of my friends, like, yeah, I want to go play Metroid, but it's all the way upstairs and my son doesn't want to come upstairs. And then it reminded me for a hot second, right, this is a portable game. I can just grab it and walk down back downstairs and play it.
We've had years and years ingrained into us that could not happen. So
it's such a hard habit to break. So hard to break. And I love that we can break it now. But I get stuck in my head that, no, this I have to be sitting in this one room for.
I think that I have only played our Switch in the living room. And I mostly play it on the TV. I definitely have gone and taken it off the dock and just sat on the couch and played.
While someone else watches TV. Right.
Yeah. But I don't think I've ever taken it into the bedroom or anything. I haven't even taken it into the bathroom yet.
I did beat Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild in the Atlanta airport. So I've traveled with it. But it's clunky to travel with because it's got like a decent sized charger that you got to bring with it. Like, I understand the battery life is fine, but it's not stellar. I understand why, in my mind, it's not a portable thing as a primary. Though I talked to people. It was funny when Hades came out. There were a bunch of people playing that. I never did. I'll eventually pick it up on sale someday. Everyone tells me it's great. I believe them. But I remember very specifically, I was playing or talking to some of my friends. Like, they were talking about, yeah, well, it's just the portable stuff. And I was like, wait. Do you guys mostly play it portably and not on a screen? They're like, yeah, well, we almost never play it on a screen. So I think it really does vary from person to person, which says a lot about, like, the versatility of that platform. It's good. I like it. Give me something that makes my life easier. That's all I want.
Overall, compared to X-Men, especially in the comics, what does this game really get right?
This game gets right the team feel a bit. It gets right some of the epic scale of it. Like, this is a big game with big consequences. What it really gets is that thing where, especially in the pre-internet, pre-Marvel Unlimited days, where you just jumped into an X-Men comic, like, and you didn't know if it was going to be good or really what was going on with it. Like, that feeling of being lost but interested in what you're missing, and like, a question, I want to know what the deal with the Stepford Cuckoos is. Like, that's in this game. It does not hold your hand about continuity or what characters exist. It just throws you in here and says, this is X-Men. You're either going to like it or you're going to walk right away. And I kind of love that. It captures that feeling of, I have to explore and understand this, and there's this massive world that I'm only scratching the surface of. Because you know that every boss is like, has like a 50 issue arc somewhere where they become this big sympathetic character. There's all these details around them. That's constant through this game, and it's really cool. And I don't feel like you get enough of that in, like, well, licensed games mostly suck now, and they mostly suck back all the time too, as you go through a podcast about licensed games, I think you can affirm some of that.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
But this game felt like unashamed that it was a licensed game, unashamed that it had to be all X-Men things. It just said, let's roll with it. Also, this game had a bunch of costumes that you unlocked all the time, and you could put them in whatever clothes you wanted them to wear, and it was great. If you want to wear the Age of Apocalypse clothes, you can do it. If you want to wear the 60s Jack Kirby clothes, you can do it. If you want to wear their good Claremont era stuff, you absolutely can. 90s Jim Lee, go for it. They had options. Also, you could wear their clothes from the Ultimate Comics if you wanted. But, you don't. Those are the boring costumes. For all these characters, those are the boring ones. Those are what you start with, and then you immediately switch to something cool.
Did we really get this far into the episode before I said anything about Deadpool being in this game?
We did. Yeah, Deadpool's in this game? Which makes sense, because 2005, Deadpool is an X-Men character. Like, he's about to... This is Cable and Deadpool era. This is when he was an X-Men spinoff with the Joe Kelly stuff in 97. And that series couldn't make sales, so it got canceled. But he was in Cable and Deadpool with Fabian Nicieza in 2004, I think, is when that came out. And that really kickstarted the character into having team-ups and all this stuff across the universe. That's really what got that push. So he's right on the cusp of being the Deadpool that a lot of us know and tolerate today. What I think is more interesting is that Iron Man is a playable character in this, if you find all the pieces of the Iron Man armor.
What?
Did you not know that? Yeah.
I missed that somehow.
Yeah, if you find the five pieces of the Iron Man armor, you can have Iron Man be with the X-Men here. Do you know why? I don't. I think it was just because one member of the dev team really liked Iron Man. Because this is, again, pre-Marvel Cinematic Universe. And what people forget is that Marvel sold their rights because they were not a movie-making company. It would be insane for them to hold on to the movie rights for characters. They had these rights because no one wanted them, because they were the trash characters. And also the Hulk rights had just kind of expired. And even then, Universal said, well, let's hold on to the distribution, which Marvel was fine with, because again, they weren't a distribution company. They were running all their other distribution through Paramount. They were fine. So this had to be just because someone wanted Iron Man in this game. There was no tie-in, media push, anything. This was some guy who really liked Denny O'Neil comics, I'm sure.
What does this game really get wrong looking at X-Men?
Apocalypse's plot is dumb, but also that is how most Apocalypse plots work. Honestly, Chris, I think this is the perfect X-Men game.
I've heard other people say that too.
It kind of gets everything right about X-Men, and the stuff that it quote-unquote gets wrong is also stuff that X-Men gets wrong. Now, you could make an argument that there is not as much of the social consciousness message that a lot of good X-Men stories have. There's not the mutant metaphor angle to this very much, which, again, I would agree with that criticism. I'd also say that, yeah, but that's not in every X-Men story. There's a lot of X-Men stories that are just to punch them up.
Every single time I see somebody trying to figure out what the best X-Men games are, this and the first game are within the top three. And that other one kind of flips around, and I think a lot of that is just based on what people grew up playing and what they're used to.
But oh, yeah.
The fact that these two are consistently in there is amazing.
Because they're great. They get what the nerd who just wants a bunch of characters that they can play and say, oh, I know this, or I want to learn more about Sunfire or whatever. You get that in this. It's for the kids who had those visual encyclopedias or the coloring books and were like, oh, who's this character? I don't know. I guess I'm going to draw him blue. It has a feeling of showing you this wider world that you just don't get in a lot of media. and especially a lot of games. It's that same weird feeling that you get like in the Lego games, where you get some weird character with you have no connection to, only instead of two buttons and a costume, you get like good voice acting and some backup and a lot of drama and a lot of story about all of these characters. It's fun. This is great. Like, I played it recently. Gameplay still holds up. Like, it's still really fun to play. They could re-release this with a handful of like quality of life updates just to make it more in line with modern expectations, and it would still be a pretty solid game, because they did the exact same gameplay on Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3, and the gameplay part of that's solid. It's all the other crap they added that's bad. If they just keep all the good stuff and all the good stuff that's in this game, they're gonna be fine.
So let's say you have somebody who wants to get into X-Men in a vacuum where this is the only game that exists. Would you give them this game as a bit of a primer course?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because of what I was saying earlier, this game makes you ask the question of, do I like this? What is this? I'm interested in this. What's this weird thing that I'm dealing with? If you want to know if you're going to like X-Men, and you kind of either like X-Men or you don't mess around with X-Men, and I get it. I'm one of the people that likes it, but I understand those who don't. This is the game you need for that. It truly is.
I think the only real good excuse for not giving somebody this one is if you already own the first one. And then that's just what's more easily accessible for you issue.
Yeah, I think that's really, yeah, it comes down to a matter of preference between those. I spent more hours on this one than I did the first X-Men Legends, so I have a deeper connection to this. And it also, the first X-Men Legends, I feel like, tries to hold your hand a bit more and like goes through the arc of Magma. And this one says, we're doing dumb X-Men stuff. Get in, nerds. And I'm here for that.
I mean, that's why we read the X-Men comics. That's why I don't particularly think of myself as an X-Men fan until I go look at what books I'm getting pulled for me at the shop. And like half of them are X-Men spinoffs.
Yeah. It rules. I love it. It's a good time.
On a totally unrelated to anything note, I have to ask this now in every episode because the fans have told me I need to do it. Who is your favorite Muppet?
Oh, Muppet. That threw me off. Wasn't expecting that. My gut says Animal, but that's probably more just because of the primary Muppets that are in a lot of things. Animal's the one that, like, he's fun. I like him. He's not necessarily the funniest, but he gets to do the pratfalls and the physical humor. Say physical, he is a puppet. But the physical humor, the physical comedy, he's great for that. I think Kermit makes for a really, really good straight man. Like, he's got the world-weary exasperation that you need from that. But I do have a soft spot for Sweetums and Uncle Deadly. I think those two are some that I have a lot of, like, it's the part in the Muppet movie where Sweetums is running after the car because he really wants to be involved and he can't because he just was one of the primary Muppets, so they don't involve him. Probably on that front. I do love Muppet stuff. It wasn't something I had a lot of growing up, but my kids did a lot, and when my oldest was three, he would sing Rainbow Connection. And I'll tell you what, there's nothing sweeter in the world than a three-year-old with a three-year-old singing voice singing Rainbow Connection to his little brother when he's just born. Like, that's the cutest thing in the world.
I'm so jealous you got to see that, not me.
I don't know what to tell you. Live my life, I guess.
Have two kids and make sure the older one knows Rainbow Connection.
That is the path to it. Like, if you're going for a game FAQs walkthrough, that's how you do it. You gotta have the kid one achievement, you gotta time it right, that's gonna be critical. And then you also have to make sure you time introducing them to the Muppets right, so that they don't get bored of it by the time the next baby's there.
I'll keep that in mind.
It's important.
Well, Zach, it has been great talking to you about all of this. If people want to hear more from you, where else can they find you around the internet?
Yeah, so I run the website ComicsXF. It's got a lot of really cool stuff there. So you can follow that account on Twitter at ComicsXF. I also run the podcast Battle of the Atom, where we go through three different X-Men stories every week, and we rank them from best to worst on our ever-expanding list of every X-Men story of all time. We have over 500 different bespoke X-Men stories on that list, and it's only growing. I do that with my co-host Adam Reck. It is very, very exciting. It's the third most popular X-Men podcast, so if you want that kind of energy, go jump into it.
It's very good, despite the fact that they decided that Marvel Apes is not enough X-Men to count to be.
Yeah, well, it's not. That's a vampire story about Captain America, and we do have some Captain America stories on that list, but specifically werewolf stories about Captain America. Those are much more X-Men than vampire stories about Captain America. It's, hey, unrelated. Is it weird that Captain America frequently fights like universal horror monsters?
Only a little bit, but I think it's cool enough to make up for it.
It is. It's just like everyone fights movie monsters. It's weird that Captain America has that as like a very frequent thing that he does.
I'm never gonna understand why it's always him. Why is it always him?
Because he's the pulpiest. Like, because he's yeah, a 40s okay. pulp hero. I think that's honestly it. Also, when did Baron Blood get invented? Because it's all his fault.
I'm going to have to look into that, because I'm not sure.
Baron Blood, Marvel. Hold on. Because I know he's a Kirby creation, and I just don't know when. No, he's a Roy Thomas. He's Roy the Boy. He's from Invaders. Anyway, that's all I got on that.
Cool.
Just ComicsXF. It's a good website. I like it.
And as always, there will be links down in the show notes, you know, in case you can't remember if it's just the letter X or if it's weird and done another way that I'm not going to name, because then that would confuse you. Just click the link. It's so much easier.
It very much is.
As always, if you want to hear more from me, the best place is to head on over to playcomics.com, where there's links to all the social media stuff, including Twitter and Facebook and Discord. And, you know, basically that's it, because I am a social media horrible person. If you want to help support the show, you can head on over to playcomics.com as well. Head over to the support page, and I am in the process of switching up some membership stuff so that you don't have to use Patreon if you don't want to. Stay tuned on the site for that. That's all I'm going to say here, because quite frankly, I don't know how I'm going to pull that off yet, but I know it's going to happen eventually, so just be ready for it. That's all I'm going to say. Don't forget that Play Comics is a part of the Gunna Geek Podcast Network, home to a bunch of other wonderfully geeky shows. Very biasedly, my favorite other one is Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D., where in a recent episode, you can see a wonderful Previously On segment that completely broke my co-hosts because it was that good. Go check it out. It is Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D. episode 415. There will be a link down in the show notes once I see that the episode is posted. If you like the music that we're rudely talking on top of, head on over to soundcloud.com/best-day to check out Best Day's music. But most of all, just grab a game, grab a stack of comics, and go find yourself a new favorite character.
Drink break.
Yeah, feel free to jump in. I know I can just talk for hours otherwise.
Why do you think I have people like you and Luke on the show?
That's fair.
So, Adam, I want to throw something out real quick.
So, my name's Zach. Like my co-host is named Adam.
So, Zach, I was thinking about your co-host, Adam, and why he's not here. And, blah. It's been fun.